We'll call the meeting to order. Welcome to the joint meeting between Agriculture Finance and Ag Policy Committee. We do have two items scheduled on the agenda here, and so we'll go ahead and get started. If we already have pulled up for the Board of Animal Health, would we like to start there? So if you'd like to move up front there, and you've been through the process a few times, but please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
And I am prepared. I just need to get my notes out here for all of you.
Representative?
Chair Anderson.
We had a comment that, we're getting the mics fixed and we'll get.
Yeah, I can't hear her.
Are they on the power?
Yes, so if we can just have you speak into the microphone, if that would be.
Sounds good. Is that better?
No, it's still. And if we could get staff to see if we can turn that up a little bit, the mic. All right.
Is that better now?
Yes, it is. All right, so once again, if you please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. Members of the committee, on behalf of the board, I'm very pleased to be here today, and thank you for the opportunity to be able to give you an overview of the Board of Animal Health. And I believe, do all of you have a handout too, or I see that screen isn't on, but.
Yes, we do. We do have a handout here, Dr.
First of all, I'm going to go through the background of the Board of Animal Health very briefly. Then I'm going to talk about some specific programs, talk about the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory, and then some diseases, and then I have just a few slides on our budget. But first of all, the background of the Board of Animal Health. We are a separate state agency, about 40 employees. We were formed in 1903. The members of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, some stockyard companies, other groups came together and asked the legislature to form and what was called at that time the Livestock Sanitary Board. Unfortunately, there were some zoonotic diseases running around the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Department of Health looked to veterinarians for help at certain point in time for diseases like tuberculosis and glanders, and that's where the Minnesota Board of Animal Health was based, is helping out not only livestock producers, but also helping out when there are zoonotic disease interests in the state. Minnesota Statute 35.03 tells you exactly what it is the board does. We protect the health of the Minnesota of Minnesota domestic animals, and we also have a chapter, the information in Chapter 35, but also have rules, too, for some of the different things that I'll be talking about today. This is a very short list. Our agency relationships, of course, the United States Department of Agriculture, Veterinary Services, Wildlife Services. Here in Minnesota, the Department of Agriculture, Health, Department of Natural Resources. And then, of course, we have a very close relationship with both the College of Vet Med and also the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, which is the official lab of the Board of Animal Health. The list that's not up there on the screen for all of you is the number of producer groups that we work with. Everybody from cattlemen's to the pork producers, Minnesota turkey growers, Chicken and Egg Association, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, all of those groups, very important for the mission that we have. And we truly are a board. That is the picture of our current board. It's made up of two veterinarians and three members from the large livestock group, cattle, hogs, and poultry. Our two veterinarians right now, Dr. Graham Brayshaw, is from the Golden Valley Humane Society, and then Dr. Matt Anderson, very good addition to our board. He's not only a large animal veterinarian, but he's on staff with one of the livestock markets in our state. Really helps us out with some of the work that we do. We have staff. I mentioned we have 40 staff. We have staff, of course, here in St. Paul. We have staff out at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory in Wilmer. But importantly, we have staff throughout the state. Our people, both veterinarians and non-veterinarians through the state, they live and work in their communities. And that's very important because some of them are livestock owners or their families are livestock owners. They understand what it is that the Board of Animal Health does and have that background within the communities. Getting into some of the work that the board does, first of all, in-state testing, and I'm going to be touching on the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab here throughout my presentation, but at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory, of course, it's testing related to poultry. If you all remember back a few years ago to highly pathogenic avian influenza, one of the issues that came up was if you had a flock out in Kandy, Ojai County, you had to drive your samples into St. Paul for testing. Albeit it's probably a couple, maybe 3 hours for that drive in. But to be able to do that testing out in Wilmer rather than driving the samples to St. Paul makes a huge difference. And we thank the legislature and, of course, the governor's office for the funding that went into the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. Very important for everybody involved in poultry here in Minnesota. We have some of our programs are related to teaching. And a couple of the examples, on the left-hand side of the screen up there, we've got somebody teaching another person how to take samples for chronic wasting disease. And just for your information, we have 459 registered herds, survey herds here in the state of Minnesota. We also have poultry testing agent teaching that goes on, veterinarians and non-veterinarians. We teach them how to collect samples, and again, this is a time saver. Rather than having a veterinarian travel out to a chicken premises or a turkey premises, the people that actually work on that premises can take the samples and get them into the lab. Much of what we do ongoing basis is preparing to respond. And this includes not only the board staff, but also all the other agencies, some of them that I mentioned in that first slide. But the critical component, of course, is farmers and veterinarians, those people out in the field. We have been taking what we learned from highly pathogenic avian influenza, and we're starting to move that into some of the other species groups. And a couple of the examples that I'll talk about is our permitting program that we got set up for avian influenza and also the interactive mapping program that we've gotten set up. And, of course, that leads us to foreign and emerging disease investigations. Our board staff continue to train, whether it's here in Minnesota or whether it's part of a larger group, such as the multi-state partnership, which takes in a large number of Midwestern states. We're all preparing to respond because, as many of you probably know, at any point in time, there are hundreds of thousands of animals on the road traveling between states. So it matters if you have a sow farm in South Dakota, if you move the pigs into Minnesota for the nursery, and then into Iowa for finishing. All of those states have to be on the same page for anything to work out when we have a foreign animal disease. And then, of course, we also have the inspecting that goes on with our field staff. Up in the upper right-hand corner, we've got one of our field staff at a fair. We permit all the fairs in the state, including the state fair. We make sure that they have a manager, an official veterinarian, and then we have staff there on fair days to make sure everything's running smoothly and that the animals are healthy. On the bottom left-hand corner, that's somebody inspecting a farm survey herd. Those herds are inspected once a year. They look at their fences. They make sure that animals are identified. They keep in contact. A lot of those survey premises, actually, our folks are out there more than just once a year. And then in the bottom right-hand side, I don't know how many of you get ducks or chicks and grow them yourself. We also inspect those poultry dealers, is what we call those folks. Might be your local feed yard, or maybe a Runnings or a Fleet Farm or something along those lines. We work with the Department of Health in inspecting those sites. We want to make sure that we get information about salmonella, good hygiene out to the people that are buying those ducks and chicks. For all livestock species, there is a piece of paper. You know, if a load of cattle moves into the state of Minnesota or a load of pigs, they will have what's called a certificate of veterinary inspection, exactly as it sounds. They need to have a veterinarian inspect those animals before they move into the state. The veterinarian certifies that they're disease-free, there's no contagious disease that's coming in with those animals, and it also has specific information on those animals. We have also, within the last 5 years, instituted permits for breeding cattle that are moving into the state. And to give you an idea, so far in fiscal year 2017, we've issued 1,700 permits for breeding cattle moving into the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, we monitor livestock movement. That kind of goes hand in hand. Traceability is very important. Animals need official identification, and that goes hand in hand with having records of that official identification. It's so important for disease response to be able to track where those animals have been. And again, to give you an example, in fiscal year 2017, we have tracked 163,000 individually identified cattle. And then additionally, at markets, we've tracked an additional 131,000 animals. And by tracked, I mean that we have the information about those individual animal IDs in our database. All in all, everything's about relationship building. And going back to what I said about our field staff, they're part of their communities. And it's so important when you have vets, farmers, the people at the feed store. What we found during avian influenza is that if you need water to foam a barn of birds to depopulate, it's the people in the community that can help you out. If you need supplies for doing whatever you need to do to clean up those poultry premises, you go to the people in the community. And that's really what our field staff is about, is having those good relationships out there. And when you have those good relationships, when it comes to controlling and eradicating disease, that's where it's at. We have a list of what's called reportable diseases. And anybody, whether you're a veterinarian or a farmer or somebody in a diagnostic lab, if you think that you're seeing one of those reportable diseases, it's mandatory that you report it to the board. That list of reportable diseases, brucellosis, chronic wasting disease, tuberculosis, the list is very long. It also includes some zoonotic concerns, too. For example, rabies. And again, to give you some numbers, in the fiscal year 17, there have been 32 animals diagnosed with rabies here in the state of Minnesota. Domestic animals, though, 2 cattle and 1 horse. We have no dogs or cats so far this year that have been diagnosed with rabies. We do like to talk about tuberculosis, which was here in the state back 2005 was when it was first discovered in northwestern Minnesota. Working through that through 2011, we became disease-free of tuberculosis, and that's very important. That disease-free status, important to our producers. You've got, when you have a disease in your state, you've got an increased cost to the producer for testing, increased cost because of movement controls. And we don't just put a bow on it and put it aside. We keep watching what's going around in the other parts of the country and close by. And for your information, TB, there's cases now in Indiana. There's also cases up in Canada. So we keep in contact with the people across the United States, animal health officials, and in other countries, too, because these diseases can come back. Switching gears just slightly, a few years ago, we started the commercial dog and cat breeder program. It was through a legislative process. Program is going well. We have licensed 123 dog or cat commercial breeders. As a reminder, a commercial breeder is somebody who has 10 or more intact animals and produces 5 or more litters per year. So there are 123 licensed breeders out there. In looking for those breeders, we found a lot of folks that are hobby breeders. They don't meet either the 10 intact animals or the number of litters per year. And we have 503 hobby breeders and don't meet the standards for the licensing for the commercial breeders. Moving on, a few slides here on the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. Again, thank you for all of you that were involved in that funding. It's an, and if you have time, let us know, and we'll give you a tour of the laboratory. It is gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful. The numbers are there in front of you. It basically quadrupled in size from 3,600 square feet up to almost 12,000 square feet. Since the grand opening, they have done almost 800 PCR tests. That is the test that I talked about initially that we had to drive samples into St. Paul for, and now they're doing it at the lab. So here from this fall, already almost 800 samples that have been tested by that new test. And in addition to that, there are a couple of new items out there. Antibiotics and stewardship of antibiotics is something that everybody is talking about now. It's a One Health approach, animals, humans, environment. And they have this new machine out there called the Sensititer, which allows them to do antibiotic sensitivity testing. Hopefully, you know, this isn't new technology, but hopefully this is going to help out our farmers and our veterinarians with understanding to target the right antibiotic to whatever bacteria that they're seeing. And then in addition to that, we also have this Luminex. They test for salmonella out at the poultry testing laboratory. And within the systems for poultry, it's very important for those folks to understand what salmonella serotype they have in their system so that they can better understand where it's coming from. And this new Luminex machine is pretty exciting, too, for our poultry farmers. The Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory is going to be part of the NALM network, and the NALM is the National Animal Health Laboratory Network. This is very important. This network helps us. It's kind of a first step towards understanding what's going on when there's a foreign animal disease possibility within the United States. It's a network of federal, state, and university laboratories. And right now, the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory is provisionally approved into this network. Another disease that has been in the news most recently.
Excuse me, Doctor. We do have a question. Terry Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that quick point, it seemed like last year some of these poultry samples had to be sent down to Ames, Iowa for confirmation. Would this change that, this new certification here?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Chair Anderson and members of the committee, that is still part of the process. They still need to be sent to the national lab in Ames, Iowa. Now, if it is an avian influenza threat, there was a change last year. I think it was the first 10 or so cases that we had. We had to wait for that confirmation from Iowa before we could move ahead with depopulation. That protocol has changed. We can move ahead on a presumed positive from the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. If we get avian influenza in the state, we want to be able to depopulate within 48 hours.
Okay. Thank you. And members, if you do have questions, just go ahead and get our attention. We can ask questions. So, Dr. Thompson, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, chronic wasting disease, and I think this slide may need to be updated. Three wild cases down in southeastern Minnesota. I think there's also information now on two presumptive positives down in that same area. We also have one farm survey herd that has tested positive, two does that have tested positive. That herd is located in Crow Wing County, so separate parts of the state, but happening fairly close to each other. Right now, that herd, that farm survey herd in Crow Wing County, there are movement restrictions on that herd, and we are working through with the owner what we can do with that herd. Those discussions ongoing, both with the Board of Animal Health and with USDA. We're doing trace outs on that herd, and the four trace outs, in other words, animals that have gone out of that herd, those premises also have quarantines on them at this point in time. This is all happening here within the last 4 to 6 weeks, so we work very closely with DNR on cases. The Board of Animal Health, when DNR had a listening session down in Preston, we were at that listening session, and of course we're giving information to the DNR about the herd up in Crow Wing County and vice versa. So working very closely between the two state agencies with the chronic wasting disease situation. Going on, the last disease that I'd like to talk about is Seneca virus A. This is a disease of hogs. And that second line, the clinical signs are similar to foot and mouth disease. I would say they're exactly the same as foot and mouth disease. Pigs with Seneca virus A will get blisters on their snout. They will be lame. They might run a fever. Exact same symptoms as foot and mouth disease. So this popped up right at the towards the end of the summer of 2015. We saw a lot of cases in the summer of 2016. Because it looks like foot and mouth disease, we need to do a foreign animal disease investigation on every single case. And so in fiscal year 17, we've had 103 cases here in the state of Minnesota, and we've treated every one of them as a foot and mouth disease case, or a possible foreign animal disease case, I should say, with samples being sent to the University of Minnesota and another sample being sent out to Plum Island for disease testing. And a plug for the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Those people are there when we have these samples, and they're testing them on Saturdays, on Sundays, at night. They're doing a very good job in helping us out with these cases. They're doing that because if hogs show up at, say, Hormel, and a lot of hogs has a couple of hogs with blisters on their snout, that whole set of hogs needs to be set aside. They can't be slaughtered until we get a negative foot and mouth disease test result. So, again, the veterinary diagnostic lab really helping the board out with this situation.
Sorry, Doctor, we have a couple questions. Representative Keel, you have a question? Oh, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to catch her before she got into the budget. I only have one question. You had mentioned that there was 32 cases of rabies in 2017. And that seems like a lot for just a short amount of time that we've been in 2017. Is that normal to have that many, or?
Dr. Thompson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, member, I don't have the information on prior years. I don't recall hearing that there was anything abnormal about that number. That includes the skunks and the wild animals. The reason that I brought it up was that there were only three domestic animals out of that 30-some, but we usually tend to run, I'd say, around 60 or 70 per year, but that includes wild animals, too.
Okay. Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then back to the lab. Is it fully functional now, or is there anything left to do, or are you guys up and running full?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, the lab itself is up and running. I think I noted on one of those slides there's still some testing protocols that need to be put into place. There's some training that needs to be done. Unfortunately, with the lab, the board was going to fund three PCR techs, again, that PCR test, and one diagnostician for the lab. The diagnostician position has not been filled yet. The university is working on that position. And with the three PCR techs, I believe one of those, they hired three, but one moved on to another position. So we're trying to get the personnel up and into the lab. But the lab itself is done, and the grand opening was this last fall.
Okay. Representative Green?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one more question. You know, you were talking about the national, looking at the national. Have you looked for specifically the avian flu, because that's forefront for us here now, looks like, in other parts of the world? I know that there was some issues in maybe Sweden and some other area. And maybe that won't affect us here. I don't know. But it's just whenever you have the problem, it seems like when it pops up, the first thing you do is wonder, you know, is something else coming? There were different strains, as I believe.
Correct.
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, I did bring information on some of the different strains that are running around the world right now. First of all, here in the United States, on August 26th or thereabout, there was a duck. Wild hunter, I think Noah is part of a surveillance program that had the H5N2 pathogenic strain. And Alaska at that time were in the middle, of their county fairs. And so they put a lot of effort into testing and watching the birds at the county fairs. And that was the only bird that was found. Just this week, Montana also announced that a hunter-harvested duck tested positive for H5N2. So there is some H5N2 just within the last months here in the United States. In addition to that, if you go to the other parts of the world, H5N8 is in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Confirmed countries are Austria, Croatia, Denmark, Germany, Hungary, India, Israel, the Netherlands, Poland, the Russian Federation, Switzerland, Iran, Sweden, Finland, Romania, France, and Egypt. And that's only H5N8. There's also H5N6 that is in Asia. I believe China, Vietnam, and maybe Japan. Maybe some Korea, too. So, members of the committee, it's a very concerning situation right now because it is transferred, as we have seen in the past, and as we're watching in Europe right now, through the different paths that the wild waterfowl take. And some of these highly pathogenic avian influenza and general avian influenza transfers across these different parts of the world.
Representative Green, follow-up? Okay. All right, we have Representative Hansen, Juergens, Keel, and Lurie. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on the avian influenza, I think I saw something with the one of the Asian varieties that cats were found positive, and I think, Mr. Chair, if you remember back 2 or 3 years ago, I asked about cats because they move around and people are more in contact with cats. So was that a correct detect? There were a couple cats that had died.
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, yes, that happened in Korea. It also happened in New York. There was avian influenza. It wasn't the highly pathogenic, but avian influenza that was found in some shelter cats. And I believe that also a veterinarian that worked at that shelter did come down with influenza. It's not common. It is somewhat of an anomaly that when we talk about usually an avian influenza strain will remain within poultry. A human influenza strain will remain within humans, but viruses are smart, you know, and every once in a while they will cross species.
Representative Hansen.
I think it was Jurassic Park that nature will find a way. Mr. Chair, it's kind of a visual there, but switching over to the CWD, and, you know, when we had the Orinoco outbreak, that was related to elk, and we don't have that many elk in the state, but we have a lot of deer. And so when we say farm survey, we have both elk and deer. So what are you doing with just routine surveillance with the deer, the farm deer, not necessarily elk, but has there been increased surveillance looking at the farm deer?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, part of what, first of all, you cannot have farm servants within the state of Minnesota unless the herd is registered with the Board of Animal Health. Part of that registration process is fencing that needs to be done, inventories that need to be done every year. The chronic wasting disease test is on a dead animal. Another example of that is the rabies test. You can't do a rabies test on a live animal. So any animal that is either killed on one of these premises that have farm survey or dies must be tested, and those samples, the information is then sent to the board. So we're not doing increased testing because of the farm survey herd, but we continue with what's in the law for the testing.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, one final follow-up on that. With the farmed deer, are there farms where there is the hunting on the farm, or are many of those deer transferred to sites where there may be hunting?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representatives, yes, there is hunting on some of the farm survey premises, but I don't have the exact number of the number of the premises that allow that.
Representative Hansen?
And then my follow-up question is, when there is hunting on those farms, are those deer then sampled?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thompson, you mentioned working closely with the DNR, and with respect to the deer carcasses that were found in Rochester, did any of those carcasses, that was in the newspaper a week or so ago, did any of those carcasses test positive for chronic wasting disease? Are you aware? Maybe not.
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, I am not aware of the testing that went on, was done, or why those carcasses. I heard about those carcasses, but nobody contacted the board about those.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You referred to the swine issue with the hoof and mouth and disease, or not knowing what happens to those herds when they end up in Hormel and then they're held. If they're sick, what's going on? What happens?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, if a lot of animals comes in, say 100 hogs, and a couple of them have blisters on their snout, they're put aside into a separate area. Our staff will go down there and take the requisite samples, which usually means they break the blister and take some of the fluid. They're sent up to the university. The university will turn around the test results within a few hours, usually. After we find out that they're not positive for foot and mouth disease, which is the foreign animal disease, those animals are then released to FSIS, the Federal Food Safety inspectors that are within those plants, for swine.
Representative Keel.
Thank you. What happens if they're tested positive?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, if that were foot and mouth disease, then we would stand up an incident command. USDA would be immediately involved. We would draw a circle. Going back to highly pathogenic avian influenza, we would draw a circle around Hormel. We would also find out immediately where those animals came from, draw a circle around that, and we would start in with the foreign animal disease investigation and response. And I hope that does not happen.
Representative Keel?
You and me both. My question is what is the herd then have to be destroyed like we did with avian influenza?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, There are thoughts both ways with foot and mouth disease right now. There is the capability of using vaccine to deal with a small problem. Unfortunately, if it were the first herd and we really want to, it's called stamp it out immediately, more than likely that first herd would be destroyed, yes.
Representative Keel?
I thank you. I just wanted to point out that there's a huge loss, could be a potential for a huge loss there also. And I know, as you, Mr. Chair, as you well know, that the security on the hog operation is pretty tight already. But it is a concern.
So. Yes. And Dr. Thompson, building off of that, I know none of us want that to happen, but can you assure the committee that if that would take place, are we prepared as the board, as the department, and otherwise, as a state?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I like to say that everything that the board does on a daily basis is preparing for that instance. The data that we collect in our database to the, again, going back to the relationships that we have, to the emergency planning that we do, to the training that we have for our staff, to the amount of supplies that we have put aside for this, to working with the Department of Agriculture, USDA, yes, we are as prepared as we are able to be for a foreign animal disease like foot and mouth disease.
Thank you, Doctor. We have Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Thompson, for appearing today. two questions relative to the subject we've been on. One is this Seneca virus A, is that just specific to hogs, or can that be found in other animals? And then the second one is more of a, you might want to put foot and mouth disease into a little broader context for some folks that may not understand the national ramifications that would happen if we had an outbreak. And just go back to, you know, last few years, Japan and Korea has fought with this. The biggest one that most people may remember is when they had to destroy over 1 million animals in Great Britain. But I'm interested to know, is that Seneca A, is that something unique just to hogs, or do we have to look at other hoofed animals?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, Seneca virus A is an interesting virus, because it could have been around for a much longer time. It just wasn't causing the clinical signs with the blisters on the snout and the sore feet. There's some evidence that it might have been in the United States, and it was something that we just weren't paying to because there were no clinical signs. It has been found. It can be found in cattle. It's not generally found in cattle. It doesn't cause any clinical signs or any problems in that. And there might be some other species, too, that I'm missing. Most significantly, though, it's the hogs that we worry about. Going on to your comment about foot and mouth disease, after a question I received yesterday, I did a little bit of research, and if we were to get foot and mouth disease within the United States, of course there's research all over the place as far as the economic impact of that, but if we're looking, the one that I looked at was from the Pork Board, it could be for 14 quarters, I think is what it was the estimate, $4 billion of economic loss, because foot and mouth disease not only affects pigs, it affects cattle. It's very contagious, and you know, a good example is Great Britain, what happened within that country. We would probably see the trade of our livestock, the international trade, completely shut down. And that is hugely important, not just to our farmers, but everybody involved within farming. So, again, that was one estimate. There are many different estimates out there, but that was the number that was given within that one PowerPoint that I found.
Thank you. Representative Lewitt, follow-up?
Didn't want to let that go by, that the real risk that foot and mouth disease has for on a national scale for our entire livestock industry.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to fall back on one committee, but many of the other committees I deal with, all industry in the world faces catastrophic losses on occasion, so maybe the chair could answer this question for me. In these animal diseases, whether it's in the poultry industry or hogs or cattle, if there's a disease like this, is there catastrophic insurance for farmers? I guess that's the question. So if you have $4 billion worth of loss, who's insuring that?
Dr. Thompson?
All right, that was a call a friend.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, I'm not aware of general insurance. If you're talking about on a farm-to-farm basis, but I guess I would throw that back out to if anybody knows, maybe a genetic company, meaning that the high genetics for cattle or high genetics for hogs. But I am not aware.
Yeah. I know there's insurance if you had a loss to, like, fire or something like that. But on the disease side, I'm not so sure. And staff is Googling it right now.
Wow.
Representative Keel.
I believe not. Insurance covers part, like you said, if there's a fire. My brother's actually lost a herd of bred sows, so you can imagine they usually have about 12, 15 babies. And they lost the whole to a methane gas poisoning. was a July day that was 90 degrees, and the powers, they were younger, and it just worked the way it did, and they lost it, and that was it. That was just a loss. So, and I don't believe there is much for most animal insurance for animals. So, and you do have loss anyway, right? You see loss just when they're born and those types of things. So, I don't know.
Mr. Mahoney? No?
Just surprised. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No.
Representative or Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment on that, I think if there are large-scale losses and animals have to be put down, there's indemnification programs, usually from USDA, so the entire loss wouldn't be held accountable, I wouldn't think, by farmers, but there would be some help, I think, from USDA with indemnification.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Anderson, is this a state and federal indemnification? Is that what we're doing? I mean, I now remember the avian flu, and we picked up a bunch of costs. I don't know what it all was. But as a business, there's no catastrophic loss insurance for farmers, what you're telling me.
Correct. I would say that's correct. Have liability coverage, for actual disease, I would say no.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably want to add on, if I could, and put it in context of the high path avian last year. That's correct. What we learned is that there's the federal indemnification, but one of the reasons why we had to bring the lab space out to Wilmer was these flocks were dying in a matter of a couple days, and by the time they got out and confirmed that it was the high path, the whole barn would already be dead, and the indemnification was only for the animals that were lost after it was diagnosed that they had it. And so the speed at which determining this was very much had to do with an economic problem, and in the early herds, I believe, the people that lost their herds quickly because we couldn't do anything about it because it was happening so quick, they just lost the money, is the way I understand it.
All right, thank you. Any other questions on this portion? No? Dr. Thompson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to add on what was just commented to Representative also with high path avian influenza, as I talked about, that confirmatory test triggered the indemnification, and it was on the live birds that were still standing. They weren't indemnified for what had already died, and that's why it was so important to get that testing done quickly too. So it was only on the live birds. If the whole flock it was deceased, then they weren't able to get indemnification on the dead birds.
Representative Bly.
One of the issues I remember when I was looking at this too is that sometimes it's unclear who owns the animals, and I'm wondering if you have any information about whether or not that would influence the question of insurance, just for clarity, so that the federal indemnification is just for the birds that they destroy, so that it doesn't go further, that disease can go further. Anyway, if you have any insight on that.
And can everybody check their microphones, please? And we're having some feedback there. Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do not have any information on, if for insurance purposes, if it matters as to ownership.
So, and that may be a decent topic for a future hearing. So, okay. Ripson Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm probably getting into weeds where I probably shouldn't get, and I should know better. But on a much smaller scale, this sounds like what we did with the finance industry back in 2008. Huge catastrophic losses, there was no insurance for it, and the feds came in and propped everybody up. It just, after 20 years of dealing with private business, in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee,
there's always a piece that has insurance. So that's just why I'm kind of surprised at it. But it's stuff for me to learn.
Thank you, Rep. Mahoney. Representative Hansen.
I was working on the mic issue there.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a few slides on our budget, and we will provide more detailed information in future hearings as needed. Generally, the Board of Animal Health's budget, we think about it as three pieces. 87% of it is through this process. We do have cooperative agreements with the federal government. That's another 9%. And there are also fees that we get through the Servaday program, through a couple other programs that make up about 4% of our budget. In this slide for fiscal year 17, you can see it at the number at 6.7 as the budgeted expenses. We do have it broken out there. All other expenses at 17%, salaries and fringe at 55%. Vendors, IT, travel, and rental space make up the rest of the expenses for the board. And then lastly, through high path avian influenza, the board was given money through the legislative process. And again, we really appreciate how quickly we got the money to be able to fight high path avian influenza. $1.8 million, and then the tag is what I call it, of poultry or avian influenza related was taken off, and we were able to use that money for general emergency planning. There's $1.3 million of that money left in with the board. And just to inform you on some of the different projects that we're working on right now, specifically for that emergency response and planning money, first of all, we're working on a direct link with the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab for test results. Right now, test results are either emailed to us or we also get paper copies of some of the test results. And what we're working on is the ability for the lab to directly put those test results into our database. So we're getting rid of paper and we'll get instantaneous test results. The second thing that we're working on right now, and we're in the middle of it, is going out to our county regions. There are a number of counties that we're reaching out to. We learned during avian influenza that we could have probably done more with the counties, and we want to put into place an ongoing training with our county responders. There are people in the state that move on. There are people in the counties that move on. We don't have a disease emergency every year, so we want to have an ongoing dialogue and put a system into place with our counties. Thirdly, I mentioned earlier about permitting and mapping. We built some really good technology during avian influenza. If I had the infected flock and if you were in the circle that was drawn around my farm and you wanted to stay into business, there was permitting that needed to be done so that you could continue to move your turkeys, your feed, your propane. What we want to do now is expand that to all species. So if we do have, heaven forbid, foot and mouth disease, or if we have a pig-specific disease, that permitting process is going to be in place for all of the pig farmers or all of the cattle farmers. And in addition to that, we also want to put the mapping that we did for avian influenza out there for all of the different species. And this includes a lot of IT work. It includes work with our company that helps us with our database. So funding is going to be channeled into those different programs. And then lastly, business continuity plans. The different groups, whether Minnesota Milk, or whether it's the pork producers or the cattlemen, or again going back to poultry, we want to make sure that on the government side, we are working so that we can keep those businesses in business. And again, that's a lot of outreach. It's a lot of looking at business continuity plans. And it includes some of what I've already talked about, you know, the permitting, the mapping, making sure that those people that are in that area or in that state are able to continue to do business. So it's a lot of reaching out to people, which is what we enjoy doing at the Board of Animal Health. Then lastly, summary slide some of the different responsibilities that I didn't touch on, everything from some of the diseases, again, anthrax, mycoplasma, salmonella, to some of the different programs that I did not talk about are listed on this slide, whether it be carcass disposal or garbage feeding. And again, if you have any questions about those, just let us know and we'll be able to answer any of those questions. And lastly, I'm finished, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if there are any additional questions.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Any additional questions? Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I looked at the mission statement and listened closely to what you were saying, and I think after a few years here, you know, in various agencies, you see agencies that work with their constituents, and so they get siloed into their constituencies. And I think it happens with DNR, where they work with the conservation groups. I think your last few comments brought up kind of my concern, is that as state agencies, I think the task is to represent all people, not just the stakeholders. And so if the task is to be, and I think working with stakeholders is important, but at some time conflict could occur between a mission of working with the stakeholders and working for the general or the greater good. And so how do you balance that? And I think particularly with smaller agencies who have very defined constituencies, it's harder, where people may not know, who aren't involved in that, what you do. Maybe the follow-up question is, how do you bring your story out to the folks who aren't involved in it, other Minnesotans who you're working for, but may not be aware of how you're protecting the food supply or their public health? That's probably two questions there.
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, it's a very good question, two questions. I think a good example of something that the board does to serve the greater good across the state of Minnesota, we are involved right now with an antibiotic stewardship program. Certainly not within our wheelhouse. Well, somewhat, but we generally don't get into individual veterinarian diagnosis and disease and what antibiotics they use. But through this collaborative, and this includes not only state agencies, but private groups, citizens that are involved in animal, human, and environmental, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is get that story out to, you know, what is it the Board of Animal Health does versus the Board of Veterinary Medicine? We get that question all the time. So we do some of that. It's probably not what we talk about all the time, but there is a component of that in what we do.
Representative Hansen, follow-up?
You okay?
Representative Soick?
I don't want to dig a deep well on this, but you mentioned things like breeders, cats, dogs, that kind of thing, and the transfer of them into the public market. Do you deal with, like, genetic degradation as well as disease, or is that primarily just the disease path in that relationship? And then at what point or how do we try to be aware of and or touch the non-licensed source of puppies and cats?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, with the commercial dog and cat breeder legislation, we deal only with the commercial, what fits into that definition. Certainly when we're doing our investigations to figure out if somebody is commercial versus non-commercial or hobby, there is some information that passes there. The disease interest with commercial dog and cat breeders is brucellosis. There is a protocol for our commercial dog and cat breeders within the law dealing with brucellosis. We don't get into the genetics or any of the other issues. We strictly follow what was handed to us within the law.
Representative Sauer?
Follow-up? No? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thompson, I really enjoyed your presentation. I think you speak very well. You use your words wisely and say what you have to say, and I really appreciate that. And I think with the changing of the guard at the Board of Animal Health, we're still in very good hands, so thank you very much. And just let members know that the chronic wasting is a very timely topic right now, and we will be having a hearing to get into that a little bit deeper in the Ag Policy Committee. We'd like to invite you back again in a couple of weeks to talk about that in more detail and what's happening. Department of Ag, as you mentioned, handles the cervidae animals, and the DNR works with the wild animals. But again, we will be having a hearing on the chronic wasting in a couple of weeks in the Ag Policy Committee. So thank you much, and please come back again.
Yes, and I too would just like to say thank you to you and all your staff. And it was interesting. We had FFA students last year. They came up and testified, and they had said that they just came back from their national convention, and they said, we were so proud of the state of Minnesota on how everybody pulled together under your leadership and others, so thank you so much. Everybody pulled together to deal with the avian influenza piece, and it was just fun to hear that from Minnesota's finest. So thank you, Dr. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
All right. We're going to move into the next portion of this. If we could help staff step up and assist with getting the presentation fired up, and we would invite the representatives from AURI to come forward at this time. Yeah, and I think that worked out pretty well, too. So if you have questions as the presentation is taking place, just go ahead and get our attention. We'll take questions throughout the presentation. And Senator Scogin, once a senator, always a senator, right?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that some people remember.
Right? And you have 45 minutes, and we will end right up at 12 o'clock or before.
Appreciate that.
So please state your name for the record and begin.
Chair Hamilton, Chair Anderson, and members, Dan Scogin, Director of Planning and Government Relations for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. For members new to the legislature or new to the Ag Committee, today I think you're going to hear a compelling and an impactful story about AURI. It was nearly 30 years ago that, much like today, farmers were producing huge crops and suffering under low commodity prices. And that's when the legislature tried to relieve that pressure, but not with a bailout. They tried to relieve that pressure by creating AURI. And they tasked us with fostering long-term economic benefit for the state of Minnesota through value-added agricultural products. I have two people with me today that are going to tell that story. We are going to hear from the AURI Executive Director, Shannon Schlecht, but we'll start our presentation this morning with AURI Board Chair, Ron Obermuller.
Thank you. Again, if you'd simply state your name for the record and begin.
Chair and committee, Ron Obermuller, director on the board of directors. It just be the second time I got to listen to Dr. Beth Thompson talk. It hit me today that she's talking defense. We get the next 45 minutes, we get to talk about offense for the state, kind of where we're going, what we can do. So I think my job's more fun than hers. I'm sorry, but AURI was created by the legislature or in statute. I think it's 28 years ago now. I think we've got a very good story to tell. It's one of those jobs you get once in a while when you volunteer that stretches your thought processes. You get to meet a lot of people. It's enjoyable to see where we can help move the state forward and what we can do to create jobs and create tax base and help the entrepreneurs. I mean, generally we work with the small people. We don't work with the large corporate. Well, yeah, we do work with General Mills and stuff, but we're feeding off of them more for ideas than actually working for them. Like I say, we were created by the state legislature 28 years ago. Our mission is to foster long-term economic benefits to the value-added agricultural products. Our job is to get rid of commodities. We do not get into production agriculture. That's not our part of it. That's not our world. We have a unique set of services to service our customers. Access to the subject and information. A lot of what we do is we go to meetings around the country and bring information, bring things back to Minnesota. We do not do basic research. We do not create much. We do some initiatives. We do a little bit of research. But basically, we are helping to expand the job base and what's going on in Minnesota. We got three labs around the state. I'm not sure which is our next. Okay. Did we go right past the? Try to get into the structure of the organization a little bit. We create about 600 jobs in the last 6 years. A lot of these are new jobs. Doing our strategic planning stuff, we expect to create another 326 in the next 5 years. We try to not be too optimistic. None of these are multipliers. Your actual jobs, one to one. There is $86 million in new capital investment in Minnesota since 2010, and $139 million in potential capital investments that we expect to happen by 2021. 76 million in new gross sales resulting from what AURI has worked with. We like to take some credit for it, but I mean, we're part of the group that moves all these things forward. And we help to account for 324,000 tons of commodities consumed in the state processing. Okay, board of directors, this is set by state statute. We got three commodity groups represented on there right now. It's corn, soybeans, and beef. We have two agribusiness. One is by a Cargill, Representative Joe Zulo. One is by John Goyle, which is an ag nutritionist. The two major farm groups are represented, Farm Bureau by John Gilbertson, Farmers Union by Jerry Hasbro. We have no clue who our representative from the State Senate Finance Committee is, but we're very glad to hear we get Deb Peel back. She's been a very important part of the board. She knows when we're scratching our heads that she might get a tough question in board meetings, so we greatly appreciate her being there. So she's done a lot for us. Locations in Minnesota. Our office is in Crookston. Most of our people actually work in virtual offices. We're spread across the state, but that's where we basically call home. Marshall, we're at the Minsku College there. That's where our meat labs and a lot of the food processing and a lot of that kind of stuff we get into. St. Paul, we just have an office at the University of Minnesota. We got a couple people in the office. Wauseka ends up being our material processing. We do grinding, anything with materials to densify it, or I guess for aquaculture, one of the last projects they're trying to figure out how do you get the right amount of protein and get the small pellets to float just right for shrimp to eat them for aquaculture in Minnesota. So very, very, very good people in all these offices, staff. I think we're right at, 25 people on staff for AURI, very talented group. One of the things we start dividing things up, we have projects which are basically with our clientele. A lot of that is confidential. That is their information that we develop. That is not public domain. They pay or depends on the size of them. how the pay structure works on some of this. We're trying to take the money we get from the state and spread it as far as we can, accomplish as much as we can. The other thing, besides projects or initiatives, these are ideas that we bring back or we see need more development and figure out how to use them in Minnesota. I mean, the initiatives are basically public domain. And let Shannon.
Very good. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Shannon Schlecht, Executive Director at ARI. I've been with the organization for about a year now, and looking at what are ways that we can add value to the crops that are grown here in Minnesota or have the potential to be commercially grown in Minnesota. So I'll speak a little bit more to some of the specific projects and what that looks like. In terms of how we look at our agricultural commodities and our breakdown, we look at four focus areas. And those would be bio-based products. So what are ways that we can use the agricultural crops that are growing here to replace petroleum-based products? Co-products, which Ron mentioned, are working with Sika in terms of what are our new uses, possibilities for those side stream products or those waste products that we often think of in food processing. How can we add more value to make that incentive or to make that investment in processing more attractive through higher revenues? Food is an area that we've seen tremendous growth with the local food movement and the number of food entrepreneurs and just that entrepreneurial spirit that we see across Minnesota in terms of looking at new products, product development, moving ideas into the commercial channels. And then finally, renewable energy, which has had a long history here in Minnesota through ethanol and biodiesel. And we still do a lot of work in supporting those industries and looking at new renewable energy sources as well, such as biomass, and how we can contribute through agricultural residues and new uses there. These are often gray lines as well as we look at these focus areas, because when you look at renewable energy, there are co-products in terms of ethanol production that it's sometimes tough to classify them in one area, but we feel these four areas really do cover the gamut of the work that we do. We also fall into serving the entire state through those four locations and four offices that were mentioned. And as you look at a breakdown, this is a little difficult to read, and it will be in our legislative report that's submitted by February 1st. We do look at roughly 60% probably of our projects fall in greater Minnesota and outstate, and about 40% in the metro area. So we are covering the entire universe, you could say, of the state of Minnesota through the investments and the processing that's occurring in the food and agricultural industry across the state. A typical year for us, as we look at those projects and initiatives, in 2016 we had 211 projects that ARI serviced throughout the state of Minnesota. About 135 of those were with clients, so those were confidential business projects that we were working on with small businesses, with entrepreneurs, and with other companies. And then the remainder are the initiatives. And as Ron mentioned, those are where we look at talking to stakeholders, talking to the partners that we have. What are some information gaps that exist in the state of Minnesota that we can help fill those information gaps, create some awareness of products that we see outside of the state of Minnesota that we can bring in and see if there's some commercial potential here. And that falls into the initiative work. We keep busy. As you can see, we initiated about 115 projects in 2016. That's July, June a year. And we closed about 138 projects last year. So there's a lot that's moving through our doors and all these different areas of work that we're doing. The next slide gives just a quick breakdown in terms of the focus areas that we're working in. So you can see where we spend a lot of our time and energy in terms of what is the demand for resources to help move ideas into commercial channels. And we see a lot of activity in the food focus area, and a lot of that does look at food entrepreneurs. And I think we see just that movement occurring outstate and within the metro area in terms of how do we get a product to the marketplace? What do we need to get done? We need UPC labels. We need nutritional analysis for panel fats. We need to look at what are some ingredient alternatives that we could be looking at. How do we move a product from a couple of days of shelf life to, say, 30 days or 60 days so that it's commercially viable? Those are all activities that ARI is providing to help food entrepreneurs move their product forward. We have renewable energy as well. You can see the numbers there have been declining since 2012. due in large part just to economic cycles and the energy cycle. It's not as cost competitive for us as we look at new energy sources, but we still maintain efforts there. And I'll speak about a biomass project a little later on in the presentation. Bio-based products is an area that I think has got a lot of potential. USDA came out with a report last year looking at 2014 saying the bio-based economy contributed $400 billion to the U.S. economy. There's just a lot of potential there as we look at the ag biosciences space, the opportunity that agricultural products can be used to replace petroleum. ARI was featured in that report from USDA as well, as were several companies in Minnesota in terms of what's being done here to look at agricultural production in the state to be used in the bio-based economy. And then coal products is an area that we see increasing demand, and you can see that number turning around there towards the later years. And as companies look at ways of creating new revenue, as times are a little bit more challenging, we see a lot more interest in approaching our coal products lab for additional assistance. So Ron mentioned a little bit of our relationship with the legislature. We were created in 1987 by statute, in existence for almost 30 years. Really our goal, as was said, is to create demand and new utilization for the state's commodities. And we do have representation, as was mentioned, on the board of directors with Representative Keel and a member of the Senate Finance Committee as well. When we look at our budget, and we are very grateful for the partnership that we have with the legislature, you provide roughly 78% of our funding over the last 3 years on average. So you are a major supporter of the work that's being done to move ideas that we hear about in Minnesota to the commercial marketplace. We also do receive grants and other monies through federal grants, through USDA, the Department of Energy, where we're looking for mission fits that fall into that value-added space. We do collaborative work with the research promotion councils. Soybean and corn have been some of our main partners in terms of doing some initiatives and projects with them to move ideas forward. And then we have several other collaborations through, like, the initiative foundations, through partner organizations that we're working with to provide some fee-for-service work where we have some technical expertise where we can help move those ideas forward. Just a couple of quick projects I want to hit on to give you an idea or a flavor of some of the work that we do. One is Kay's Natural. This is a company based out of Clara City that we've worked with for many years, and we're partnering with them early on in their venture into the commercial marketplace. They were awarded our Ag Innovator of the Year award this year, and they have grown, I would say, we're ahead of their time in looking at high-protein snacks and finding that market niche. They today are employing over 30 people in Clara City, doing their own products as well as co-packing for other groups. And they are now in 9,500 outlets nationwide, 80 online platforms, and are marketing their product across the United States. We provided a lot of technical assistance. We continue to do nutritional lab analysis for them for that label that needs to be on their packaging. And we can do that through our food scientists we have on staff as well as through our analytical chemistry lab that we have. Another company we've worked with is Nutrivance. And Nutrivance is based in Marshall, Minnesota. And they came to us looking for assistance on how do you remove some of the non-digestible sugars in soybean meal? How do you up that protein percentage to higher than what it is today to help target that fish meal market that exists? That's a much higher value market and has some pretty unique uses in terms of early swine feed uses and then as well as in aquaculture. So we have worked with them, and they're now producing over 2,000 tons a month of this Nutrivance material that's being used. And again, a great success. And as we look at the nascent aquaculture industry here in Minnesota that's being looked at, it's a great way to bring the fish to the feed, right? And we have companies here that can start to meet that need in terms of providing that high-protein meal that's needed. Another fun project that our group worked on was with Centava. It was on purple corn and looking at this clean label trend that we see around the food industry. So they produced a natural red dye substitute or a natural alternative to the red dye through contract growing purple corn in the state of Minnesota and processing it as well. They were recently acquired by another company, so they've been a big success. And you see their products in General Mills and other major food companies as well in terms of providing that clean label ingredient that's being sought after by the food industry. A few of the initiatives that we work on as well. I want to turn this back over to Ron for some of the bio-based road sealant. This is a unique project we started about a year ago with the Minnesota soybean growers and through some research that was done by the United Soybean Board.
Yeah, I guess I'm soybean representative, so this one's a lot of fun. That kind of excites me. Basically, for asphalt, generally you put it on a new road or to rejuvenate it. Additive that actually goes an inch and three quarters, it'll soak into the asphalt, rejuvenate it. Asphalt oxidizes just like everything else. That's why the seal coats a lot of this stuff. This product, you do put this on and reapply it. I think it's after a year old, and then about every 4 or 5 years afterwards. It costs a little bit more to apply it than to do a seal coat. But if you keep using it, I talked to the manufacturer of it. He says basically asphalt road could be perpetual. It could last forever because basically it rejuvenates the top inch and a half. It's very environmentally safe. They can shut the road down for an hour and sweep it off and apply it. In 2 hours, the traffic's back on it. Don't have to remark it. The paint comes through yet. A lot of it's being used on bicycle paths and a lot of these things. The claim is, in time, it will save you about 30% on your asphalt roads if you use it.
Okay. We do have a question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that information about this fine product. I'd like to learn what the reaction of MnDOT is to this product.
Who would like to take that? Mr. Oldman.
I guess I can work on that a little bit. Thank you, Chair and committee members. Right now it's being heavily used around Hutchinson. There's a lot of research being done on it to make sure it is what they claim it is. I don't know if we've worked with MnDOT, but we've been trying to – part of what Ori's job with this is to get the word out. So we're working with county commissioners and – working on the county level. The map you see is where it's being used in the state now. I think the original manufacturer is down in Missouri. They've used it all the way from the tropics to Alaska. We have a applicator contractor in Mountain Lake that's applying it in Minnesota. I think it's right at 100 gallons of soybean oil used per mile per lane. So for every mile we do that, that's 200 gallons of soybean oil being used. I mean, you start multiplying that by the miles in Minnesota, and it could do wonders for soybean farmers.
Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, is there any research being done independently to demonstrate that the claims of the manufacturer are indeed true?
That's a lot of what Hutchinson is doing out there. They are it is their local county engineer and stuff that is applying it and using it. And I guess one of the things that surprised me, he said he even works on concrete roads. He's claiming where they have to tear out the concrete roads after they apply it. The people kind of complain because it has made it that much stronger. It penetrates and gets into concrete. So it's quite a product, it's one of those more exciting ones. A lot of what we're doing is just basically promoting it. We have done very little bit of engineering or anything on it. I mean, it's our job is to get it out and get it used in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing else than a comment that it's yet another fine product out of soybeans. You know, we see soybeans as an amazing product in Minnesota, and so I sit on the transportation committee. I'm going to make notes. This conversation will continue in the Transportation Committee at the appropriate time.
All right, thank you. Mr. Oldman, how often do you have to apply it?
I'm thinking it's much the same cycle as you would use seal coat on it.
Okay.
But like I say, it rejuvenates the road. You aren't just sealing up the top.
Yeah.
Environmentally, there is no environment. I mean, it's being heavily used right now on walkways and bicycle paths and all these things. So it's kind of one of those things that maybe looks too good to be true. We'll find out.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if any cities are approaching you for use, or if you would know if there are any cities considering using this product.
Mr. Schleck. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee representative. In April, we had held a forum in Hutchinson, Minnesota, where they've been applying this product for a number of years now, I believe up to 6 years they've been using this product. And they are probably the best case study example we have in the state of Minnesota at this point with the city engineer and his work that he's been doing on this product. And he did that through a grant, and I'm forgetting which program that was done. But we are working with him on a literature review and having discussions. And his initial numbers were showing, I believe, a 30% reduction in the budget on their transportation costs. So it was quite substantial. But we are working to document and clarify all that.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to plan an idea then, I guess. I happen to live about a block and a half from an asphalt reheating plant and recycling, and you can imagine what that does to a community, a very dense community, in terms of smell and contamination of the air. So this is kind of interesting. It may be if there's a way that this could be tested in, you know, some of our inner city areas, I would be interested in talking to you about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. We would be happy to have further discussions on this and look at how we can create greater use of this product in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, as they know, and I'll say it out loud, I'm very supportive of the work that AURA does. I think you do wonderful work, and I think this is just one of those examples. You'll find that in any given year there's a lot of unique things that they find, and that's what I'm excited about, because we need to find those ways. That's why AUR is there. But I do have a question. On a product such as this, when you advance in your IP development, taking it from this concept into commercialization, what are some of the methods that you have with an AURI to, if you will, break it out of, you know, the concept phase into that commercialization phase? How are you helping the people do that?
Mr. Schleck. Very good, Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee. AURI is unique in its asset base, or its resources that exist with the staff that we have on board, several PhDs, doctorates in organic chemistry and microbiology and food science. So we have the expertise to take a look at these ideas that exist out there and look at them on a very technical basis and from a realistic standpoint. Then we do have program development staff on board as well that can look at this from a business development standpoint and see, is there anything like this that exists out there? Is this unique enough for us to spend some time and energy to move this project forward, or this idea forward, where there's not competition, for example, that may hinder that development? So we have this unique team that we bring together for having those discussions. And then we also do partner looking at feasibility studies with MDA, for example, with the program that they have, in terms of, you know, what are some other third-party ways that we can make sure that this is a product that has a good potential. For the bio-based road sealant specifically, this was a product that was already developed through IP through a company in Missouri with funding from the United Soybean Board. So we've been working with that company to look at what are the uses, what have been some of the problems to its moving forward in terms of the commercial applications. And we're finding out a lot of awareness issues. But we also then have the staff on board to take a critical look at this through we're doing currently a literature review against this product and others that may exist on the marketplace, and just seeing, you know, what are some constraints that we've seen towards its adoption, and how can we help overcome those as an organization. Does that answer your question, Representative?
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As this advances along, do you have ways, or how do you coordinate with existing industry into bringing some? Because I'm using the example specifically of this soybean on road surfaces. If it works great, the ability to, again, commercialize it is going to take industry influence with that. So is there a way that you coordinate with some of the established industries?
Mr. Schleck.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, yes, partnering and networking with organizations is critical to our work. We're a small cog in the wheel, you could say. So we are partnering with Minnesota Soybean, for example, with the United Soybean Board, with the manufacturer, as well as with the applicator here in Minnesota, trying to do this concept work and to move it forward. As we finish our analysis and we're more comfortable on moving forward with public awareness, we'll be reaching out to groups like Great Plains Institute and through the Department of Transportation, MnDOT, through the cities, trying to pull together forums and networks where we can get this information out and then start having those more in-depth conversations. So in terms of partnering, we need to, we have to. We're a small organization, and this is the way that success happens.
Yes.
I'm looking for some of your literature here, and I see that you work with sort of maybe private organizations or private groups. Is there a fee for these folks to work with you, and how does that work?
Mr. Schlack, and I apologize. I don't know what's going on with the microphones here.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, so currently most of ARI's services are provided on a cost-free basis, and we have done that through the support of the legislature. A lot of the companies we work with or that we see are very early stage, and they are strapped with cash resources or technical resources, and we have provided most of our services on a cost-free basis. We are looking at that going forward. In terms of, is that the best model, and how do we leverage additional funds? In terms of, should we be charging fee for service work with some of the clients that they've graduated to a certain level, for example? That's a pretty big change in our model, and we're having discussions internally with the board of directors in a working group in terms of what that model should look like going forward. When it's groups where it's not necessarily the applied R&D. Sometimes we are saying that is applicable towards a fee, for example. So there are some areas that we do charge on a fee basis, but the majority of it is done on a cost-free basis right now.
Right. Some follow-up?
Then what is the protocol for choosing who you will work with, and what makes it a viable challenge for your organization?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, that's a great question. We take a look at the mission fit, for example, as our first key criteria. Is it in the value-added agricultural space? We don't do production agriculture, and so we have to make sure that it's a value-added utilization demand piece is the first area that we look at. The next is it grown in Minnesota in terms of, is it benefiting the state of Minnesota? Those are our two key pieces that we look at in terms of taking on a project. Then we have several other criteria in terms of what is the economic impact of this project? What could it be? What is the collaboration? What is the potential demand for utilization of that commodity? We have a matrix that we use in terms of scoring all of these different factors, about 10 different factors, in terms of how that fits and then how that ranks in terms of our priority for us to put that into our queue of work that we need to do as an organization. So we do look very carefully, and this came out of a point from last year's legislative audit report in terms of how we look at how are we managing our projects, how are we bringing projects in. And we have made several changes in the last year in terms of how we approach that and do it on a more, I would say, thoughtful manner in terms of meeting basic criteria that we feel benefit the state of Minnesota. Right.
Follow up?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Please continue.
One other initiative I want to bring to your attention is a biomass for cooling effort that we took on in cooperation with University of Minnesota, University of Minnesota Extension, the CURA program, as well as with Heating the Midwest, which is an organization that several Minnesota companies are a part of. We looked at this in terms of if you're using biomass for heat, what are other ways that you can utilize that infrastructure during other months of the year? I think of an old propane refrigerator type model where there is an opportunity to use heat to cool products in different seasons. We did this in, again, a partnership and looking at what are our uses in small and medium scale facilities, apartment buildings, processing facilities, where you might be able to use biomass on a many more months out of the year. We came up with some very good numbers in terms of cost reduction that could occur versus heating oil and trying to look at what are some agricultural residues that could be used into a new use. So this is still very early stage. It was an initial concept. We'll be presenting this in partnership with groups at the Biomass Conference here in Minneapolis in April. There's a lot of potential in this type of a project as well that when I initially looked at it, I always think of biomass for heating, but there are other applications that we can look around the corner and see, what are other ways that we can put some of our agricultural commodities to use. We also have a food industry thought leaders group here in Minneapolis. A question?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hamilton. I'm just wondering on the biomass for cooling, which also is very interesting to me. Thank you for your work. But have you looked at all on using perennials for that?
Mr. Schleck.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, I think that's a great question. I think any biomass substance could be used in this in terms of a pelleting. I cannot speak specifically to a perennial at this point. We had several commodities that we looked at, but we'll definitely add that to the mix if we haven't already.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Just checking out the microphones again. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. As I was mentioning, we have this food industry thought leaders group here in Minnesota, and we have such a great wealth of knowledge of food and agricultural expertise that we thought it would be beneficial a couple of times a year to pull together a discussion group that brings in some of the large players as well as some of the entrepreneurs and small businesses that we work with, just to talk about different issues that are being faced, the challenges, to create a networking conversation around what are constraints, what's being done, and what are ideas that we can work on together to move opportunities forward. Food is the easiest area for us to do this. We're looking at expanding this into our other focus areas as well. We also have a renewable energy roundtable that we are mandated by the state to do every year, looking at what are new uses for agricultural products and renewable energy. We've looked at anaerobic digestion. We've looked at biomass. We've looked at investment opportunities in terms of what the investment community is looking at in renewable energy. There's a lot of opportunities here as well, and this is done in partnership with DEED, with MDA, with Commerce, with the U of M, and with the Minnesota State Colleges that sit on an advisory board for the Renewable Energy Roundtable to come up with ideas that we think have some commercial opportunities here in Minnesota.
All right. We do have a question from Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about your thought leaders and some of the topics you might be talking about. So something I'd be interested in hearing is if you're bringing to the table people who are doing organic farming and people who are doing urban agriculture. There's some real value-added products missing for those of us who might be interested in doing that. And you could talk about things as simple as, chicken feed, trying to get organic chicken feed that doesn't have GMO soybeans, for example, or trying to get the same thing for aquaculture. So I'm just wondering about that, and then some of the smaller scale urban farming challenges that there are. Just are any of those folks coming to the table?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, so we do bring together past clients that we've had into those discussions. We are this week at the Organic Conference talking with organic growers and opportunities that exist. A lot of the demand that we see for new products is in that organic arena. So we do have several organic producers and manufacturers, processors that we do work with on a regular basis. We probably need to do a better job of bringing everybody to the table. Part of the problem with industry thought leaders is we want to keep it to a smaller audience because that does spur discussion. So having 20 to 30 members becomes more of a discussion than it does a listening session, and that's one of the constraints that we face. But rotating members through is something that we started doing more often, and I'll make a note to bring in additional members. We do talk with the urban agricultural industry as well, and looking at aquaponics and hydroponics and what are ways that we can work on that area in terms of what are some value-added opportunities that may exist. I was just recently in California last week, and we spent an entire day looking at urban agricultural concepts that are being used in the city of Irvine, for example, and what are our methods that they're using in terms of growing the product locally and bringing it to the marketplace. So there's a lot of interesting ideas and concepts that exist, and somewhere where we need to spend more time. We don't do production agriculture, as was mentioned earlier, but looking at those value-added opportunities that exist from urban agriculture is an area of interest to us.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if it would just be possible to see a list of who you're working with, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Very good. I'll follow up.
Schleck, you have 7 minutes. We will end on time.
Excellent. Right. Excellent. I will keep moving through here. One of collaborations are very important to us at ARI. We work closely with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We have a couple of members that sit on their feasibility efforts, for example, to screen candidates. Gives us an early insight as well into potential clients or companies that we may want to work with when we see an opportunity. We also greatly support the value-added producer grants in terms of when we see equipment needs that our clients would help them move forward, that we can refer them to other programs that exist here within the state of Minnesota. An interesting project we have underway is with CERTS through the University of Minnesota, through a private company here in Minnesota that manufactures boiler units and has a distribution arm as well to bring in units from overseas, as well as then with a commercial producer of poultry to look at what are ways that we can use biomass or egg residues again in poultry barns versus using propane or natural gas. And are there some other benefits that we haven't looked at from that in terms of doing some side-by-side comparisons on air quality, on the moisture levels that may impact disease, may impact flock growth, just may increase the productivity. So we're about 1 year into that two-year study, and that is, again, a great partnership with other groups here in the state to help move those types of ideas forward. We're also doing some work with the University of Minnesota on the Forever Green Initiative on cover cropping and relay cropping. If we are going to move forward with more cover crops, are there other uses that exist in terms of the biomass that's produced and even the crop that is produced? We also do a lot of work just to support the food and egg industry and the entrepreneurial ecosystem in terms of providing judging. We have subject matter experts, so Clean Tech Open, looking at clean tech energy, looking at what are ways that we can assist there, as well as judging at the Minnesota Cup. Their food and egg beverage division is growing dramatically from when it kicked off, and we always supply staff to that effort to help move forward. Just I want to touch briefly on last year we did go through an entire program evaluation at ARI, and I thank Representative Hansen last year for our committee hearing in May to discuss the recommendations from the OLA's report. I am happy to report that we are moving forward with several of the recommendations that were made by the legislative auditor. One was measuring the impact of our work. So this year we did do a six-year survey to look at what has the impact been. We're looking at that by overall and as well by focus areas so we can better align our resources as an organization. We have now set rates specifically. Back to the earlier question that we will charge a set rate that covers our cost of service for companies that are looking for our work, where we didn't have that in place before. And we also have changed our project approval process and our project application process to look at how can we be more efficient, making sure that we're having the impact that was set out for us by the legislature. Finally, one of the other recommendations that came up during the discussion was what are we doing for the underserved communities and the ethnic population here in Minnesota. We will have a budget change request this year looking at bringing in additional staff to help us make sure that the awareness is there of our services, that we're not missing opportunities that exist across the state of Minnesota. So we are working on that as well. So those were great recommendations that we are working on. Just finally, Mr. Chairman, we see a growth in demand for our services as an organization. There's a lot of great ideas that exist across the state of Minnesota. We are now waitlisted companies for the first time. About 2 years ago, it started having to waitlist companies in food and this last year in the co-products area. So it's great to see the demand for services, and those are waitlisted because we think they have potential. We just don't have the resources currently to take everything on when it comes to us. So we will be putting forth a change request again as well for some additional resources to help us meet that demand that we see. And we're beyond doing simple projects, I would say, at ARI. Everything is getting more complex when you look at what's being asked of us. Somebody often, you often hear that everything that was simple has been done. Sometimes that seems to be the case, and other times not so much. When you have an idea like the bio-based road sealant that you know just looks like a great idea, and how did that not come forward before? And just in general, our hours that we're spending on these projects are taking much more time as our scientists try to move them forward. Finally, you know, I just want to add that this is a unique model. We don't do basic research as is done at the universities or through other funding that this committee has provided on basic research for plant breeders for different areas like that. We do applied research, working hand in hand with the commercial companies, looking back at the university system for that basic research that exists, and how can we commercialize it, or how can that help overcome a constraint that we see in the commercial marketplace. So it's a great collaboration with the university systems. I've been in this industry for over 15 years from a national and international level, and I've not seen anything like ARI. So I want to applaud you again from a legislative standpoint in terms of creating a very unique model that I think is the envy of other states and other organizations in terms of commercializing ideas. With that, Mr. Chairman, we keep busy. I believe we're having a great impact on bringing new value to rural Minnesota, to metro Minnesota, to moving ideas forward. And I want to thank you, want to thank all of our partners, again, because we can't do this without the support of many across the state of Minnesota. And this is just a handful of the partners that we work with. Over the 25 years, this is just a quick map of all of the locations that ARI has serviced clients. So we work, again, statewide. Metro and rural areas to really try to have an impact across the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes left if there's any questions for the testifier. 2 minutes. Otherwise, your contact information, right? So any one of us can get a hold of you, right, Mr. Schleck? Get a hold of you if we have any questions moving forward. I want to thank you. You did a wonderful job with your presentation. And I know we've had a few changes along the way, and thank you to the board as well for your management through those changes and everything. I think we have a very good person here, Representative AURI, so I want to thank you for that. And with that, Senator Scogin, did you have something additional to add? You have 1 minute.
Innovator of the Year Award winner, Dave Natfield of Clara City, has some snacks for you if you want to pick one up on the way out.
All right. What a great way. What a wonderful way to end the meeting. So with that, members, we are adjourned.